Hello, I'm Dr. Yishan. Welcome to Deep Into Sleep podcast. I'm a licensed clinical psychologist and board-certified behavioral sleep medicine specialist. So according to a 2022 national survey on drug use and health, so in the past year, there were about 28.8 million adults were diagnosed with alcohol use disorder. Among this large population, only 2.2% received some kind of medication-assisted treatment for alcohol use. So you can see there is a huge gap between the needs and the access to treatment for alcohol use disorder. Also, alcohol use actually is very closely related to our sleep health. So some people use alcohol to self-medicate, to help themselves to fall asleep faster. But alcohol actually end up suppress our deep sleep, suppress our dream sleep, and even could make our sleep breathing problems worse. So many people have a difficult and challenging relationship with alcohol use. So today we have Jonathan and Dr. Lee from Aura Health to discuss with us the relationship between alcohol use and sleep health. They will also discuss some medication treatment options for alcohol use disorder. So let me introduce our guest a little bit. Jonathan Hunt Glassman is the co-founder, CEO at Aura Health and has some personal experiences battling with alcohol use disorder. Dr. Joshua Lee is the chief clinical advisor at Aura Health. He specialized in medication-assisted treatment of alcohol and opioid use disorders. He is also a professor at NYU Grossman School of Medicine. He leads the Addiction Medicine Fellowship and conducts research, works on justice and community outcomes. So this will be an interesting conversation, combining both some research data and some personal stories. Hope you like it. Hello, welcome to Deep Into Sleep podcast. We have Jonathan and Dr. Lee today, and we're going to dive into the topic of addiction, and especially how addiction may be linked to our health and our sleep. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
So first, I'm curious, what gets both of you interested in this addiction world?
I can start on that, and Josh can follow. I started working to help people who want to drink less or quit, which is what we do at Aura Health, because I needed help drinking less myself. I had a problematic relationship with alcohol from the day I started drinking in high school. What started as binge drinking became a pattern of drinking to blackout. And then as I saw peers of mine start to put excessive alcohol use behind them, the opposite was happening for me. I was drinking more and more, experiencing more and more physical, mental health symptoms, consequences in personal relationships and at work. And tried a lot of different solutions to get a handle on that problem. AA meetings, therapy, but the real turning point for me was prescription medication that made it easier to achieve my goal of drinking less. And as pleased as I was with those results for myself, it also opened my eyes to the reality that there are 30 million people in the United States who have an alcohol use disorder, most of whom don't receive treatment at all, even fewer of whom are prescribed a medication to help them drink less or quit. And all of that struck me as an opportunity to help a lot of people and build a business by doing something like what we do at Aura Health.
Yeah, thanks, Jonathan. And I've as a person, I've also used drugs, nicotine, alcohol. I don't come here with a recovery story. I was in primary care as an internal medicine trained doctor in New York City. And addiction medicine was kind of becoming, over the kind of early part of my career, like a new focus for people like me who where in primary care, we're internal medicine, kind of GP-driven practices, but really liked behavioral health, talking to patients about behavior change, and then using new medications for smoking, drinking, and opiate use disorders that I'm sure we'll cover today. It just became kind of an opportunity for me career-wise, and I found that I really liked doing the work and working with the patients on these kind of problems in a primary care setting. And then I also was doing work in the New York City jails at the time, both research and patient care. And obviously, addiction disorders have a lot to do with our criminal justice system and the kind of overlap between mental illness, substance abuse, poverty, and criminal activity and justice involvement. That has been a topic of mine in terms of like policy and clinical trial research. And addiction is a huge part of that. So that all has kind of come together, you know, for me over the last 20 years during my medical career. And here we are. And then I started working with Jonathan during the pandemic on this idea behind OrHealth, which really kind of summarized a lot of what we've been working on and saying in academic medicine, but we weren't doing a great job of like kind of making a reality, which is getting effective medications out to people for alcohol in a kind of simple, effective, cheap versus expensive way, and essentially just get more people into treatment that works. A big problem we have in the country is we have stuff that works and we have people with a problem, and we just don't historically connect them. It doesn't really make sense, but that is kind of where we're at. And getting more people to kind of realize there's good treatments out there is a big priority.
Right, access. My clinic has a branch, has office in New York also, and our psychotherapist there actually specialize in substance abuse disorder, but more on mental health, behavioral health aspect. So it's interesting when you mention that, because I'm wondering, I read some data back in pandemic, like 2020, I remember there were a huge increase of addiction behaviors throughout pandemic than before. It was already a problem before, but I heard it got worse, especially also among healthcare providers, even like for high stress jobs. So I'm curious about the data. If Dr. Lee, you can share with us how severe the problem is right now and what that looked like.
Yeah, most of the indicators that are early, mid, and then we're still kind of gathering what's become of us all after kind of the pandemic. People were idle. People were stressed out. People were anxious. Those are all, you know, settings where substance use might go up. We saw increases in smoking, you know, state by state. You can, for instance, track like sales and taxation. And those were all of a sudden going up a little bit, not dramatically, but that is really different than the last like 30, 40 years, where year by year, smoking rates in adults have generally gone down. Drinking, we think, got worse. We heard this anecdotally. You would hear it from patients. Drinking, we think, got worse across the board, but particularly with women. That has become a kind of increasing area of concern, and that got worse during the pandemic. Alcohol-related deaths have been kind of increasing year by year through the last like 5 years. And then the opiate overdose epidemic got worse. We know that deaths related to opiate and other drug overdoses increased during the pandemic. Some of that is the fentanyl story. There's more and more dangerous opioids out there, and that was happening before the pandemic and continued. So that was maybe not about so much lockdowns or work from home or schools closed. But whatever the case may be, we saw what we had kind of achieved a little bit of kind of control or plateauing of overdose death rates nationally before the pandemic. And that it kind of went back to getting worse. So it looks like across the board, people did use more drugs, alcohol, tobacco kind of during the early and mid pandemic. And that had deadly consequences and certainly quality of life consequences.
Mm-hmm. And Jonathan just mentioned also in your personal story, you start drinking around teenage years. It's interesting. I just read some papers talking about if a teenager start drinking around teenage age, it's four times more likely for them to develop into later alcohol abuse disorders than other people get like start drinking until they are adults, like 21. So I don't know, is that like already we know how this may impact younger adults, teenagers versus adult, and are those a population you guys work with to help bridge the gap of the medical treatment access?
So I'll let Josh kind of talk about the development of the disorder over a person's lifetime, maybe broadening from my experience and commenting on ways that it's representative or not representative. To answer the second half of your question, at Aura Health, we only serve adults. And that's not to say that there aren't minors with alcohol use disorder. But that's where we've found comfort in terms of our telemedicine solution is focusing on an adult population 18 and up.
Yeah, I would just say for development, probably you're absolutely right. The later people wait for any initiation of any risky behavior, including most substance use, the better. So if you can smoke cannabis but do it in college, that's better than middle school or early high school in terms of your risk of a disorder later in life or as an adolescent, of course, in terms of your overall kind of abilities, achievement, motivation, social and academic kind of keeping on track. And so that we can say that with most substances, the later, the better. The if you're using as a kind of fully formed adult, for the first time, you're less likely to find it super novel, fall in love, or start to prioritize repeated use over other stuff you got to do in life. So that is for sure.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm wondering what are the negative consequences you have noticed that addiction behaviors may impact people. Myself, I used to work in an addiction facility as a psychologist years ago. Mm-hmm. And what I noticed, there's something related to sleep that back then I was not even in the sleep specialty. I noticed when people are trying to, you know, get rid of the addiction. And after, because in the facility, you have to live there for a while, you don't have access to any drugs or alcohol. And they start having super vivid dreams, a lot of REM sleep. In very intense dreams. So sounds like a REM rebound effect. And also there's a lot of patients there have relationship issues and the divorce rate is really high and family dysfunction rate is really high. So from both of your perspective, no matter it's like personal experience, what you see from other people and research-wise, science-wise, can you help us understand like what are the common consequences of addiction behaviors?
Yeah, well, you bring up sleep and that's a huge, I think that's a, it's a kind of understood quality of life and just basic daily function that we kind of take for granted, but when it's not working out well is a huge problem. It's a reason for people to use or use repeatedly. It can be a trigger, like I don't sleep well, I'm always tired. That's a very common kind of patient narrative about, you know, when I used, why I used. And then when people are early in treatment or in frank withdrawal, say, if you're doing initial kind of like trying to quit drinking or I'm trying to get off opioids or I just quit cigarettes. Poor sleep is often a feature of the first kind of week, 2 weeks, 3 weeks, month of trying to get past kind of regular substance use, whether or not you're getting proper medication treatment at the same time. And that can itself be a trigger then for what's commonly called relapse, you know, just going back to using even though you've made an attempt to quit or you know, start a recovery process. And then when things are going well in treatment, and our medications can help with this, naltrexone for alcohol, we don't associate as like a sleep medication. It's not a sedative, but it can generally help you feel better overall, help you feel better and less obsessive about alcohol when you're not using. And we know that alcohol itself disrupts sleep. So it disrupts the REM cycles. You can use it to kind of fall asleep, but it's a pretty terrible sleep drug in terms of an actual continuous night of sleep. And so being off that, if naltrexone is helping you with that, your sleep actually, you know, on average is going to get a lot better. So that's one of the great benefits of treatment across the board in addiction is getting people to have better sleep, wake, and just kind of healthier kind of lifestyles. And that, you know, is kind of the whole point, and can be such a relief for people that, you know, have had trouble with that the whole time.
We've at Aura Health now served over 30,000 individuals. And so as you can imagine, their stories and responses to treatment are as varied as they are. But one of the more common first glimmers of hope and improvement that people often report as they're cutting back their dependence on alcohol is quality of sleep. You know, I've heard again and again, I'm waking up earlier, feeling refreshed because my night hasn't been interrupted by the effects of alcohol. And often, you know, that first noticeable improvement is a really important milestone for our members because they've taken this leap of faith that drinking less or quitting is going to make a difference in their lives. And then one noticeable change starts to unlock others. They feel better in the morning, so they're engaging with their spouse and children at breakfast in a positive way. They're getting to work on time and having a productive first few hours. And this kind of virtuous cycle can begin to go into motion. So sleep is a near and dear indicator of progress for a lot of our members.
Yeah, that's good to know. And because it's interesting, a lot of people start using drugs or alcohol is because they're going through something and use that as a coping strategy to help them sleep. We possibly know it actually hurts sleep somehow. And now there are also a lot of CBD products on the market. And or some people just rely on marijuana to help them to sleep. And I don't know, when you work with people in our house, have you noticed that? And is there like any misperceptions around that?
Cannabis and alcohol are pretty commonly used together. Like if you have a group of people with an alcohol problem, and then you look for the other drug people are most commonly using, it would be cannabis. We can treat you for an alcohol use disorder with naltrexone, regardless of your status as a cannabis user. As far as cannabis and sleep goes, I think it's a huge unanswered question. A lot of proponents of cannabis, like the medical marijuana kind of side of life, have for a long time promoted it as a sleep aid, as kind of non-toxic, non-addictive compared to something like Valium. And I think that we don't know. We don't have a great many good cannabis trials, in part because it's still Schedule I and restricted by the feds. But if we were to research it more broadly in kind of typical sleep clinical trials, we may or may not find it has good effects or it has knock-on side effects that we're not recognizing that are also important. So I don't know the answer, but certainly I agree. It's widespread in terms of the use now of both cannabis as well as other cannabinoid and CBD products for sleep.
Okay, so both of you are working on Aura Health right now, and I read data definitely for people with addiction, and very small portion of them are seeking treatment. I think there's a lot of reasons, and access to treatment possibly one reason. And you mentioned briefly earlier that you're really trying to bridge the gap. So can you please explain a little bit what both of you are doing in this field to really help out and this problem, what Aura Health is? Yeah.
Sure. As you said, there are many barriers and contributors to the gap in treatment and reaching all of the folks who are struggling with a substance misuse problem in this country. So there are a lot of places that one could start. Where we've started is by trying to be the most approachable place to get started drinking less or quitting. And what we've learned from our members is that approachability for them means two main things: privacy and convenience. Those are the things that have held them back from seeking treatment in perhaps more traditional settings, even though they have the goal of drinking less or quitting. And so that's what we have tried to engineer our solution to address. People come to AuraHealth.com. They can learn about alcohol use disorder and medication-assisted treatment. And if it feels like it might be a good fit for them, they can get started right away, connecting with a doctor or a nurse practitioner who's licensed in their state. That person collects information about the prospective member's history of drinking, their health in general, and then puts together a treatment plan for them. That often includes recommendations of psychosocial support, so think support groups, self-help, but also in many cases, a prescription for naltrexone, which Josh can talk more about the properties of which, but the basic idea is it's the recommended frontline medication to help people drink less or quit. And then keeping on with the privacy and convenience theme, at the member's option, we can ship them that medication from our partner pharmacy in discreet packaging that comes to their front door so that they can get started on medication and take that first big step towards their goals completely from the privacy of their own homes.
Yeah, and I would just kind of contrast that with my work at a hospital in New York City. I work at a public hospital. It's associated with the medical school where I am, NYU and Bellevue Hospital. We're there to treat you. I show up at my clinic per week and we have an emergency room. And if you have a real severe case, you can get admitted to the hospital. So we have all sorts of kind of stuff we can do for your alcohol. But we're not reaching out into the community on a daily basis to like, hey, we're here. Hey, did you realize there's something we could do for you? So there's that kind of lack of connectivity between like people walking around in their daily lives with this problem and then the medical center based treatment, which could include the same prescription that OAR would like to give you. And so that's why I've kind of enjoyed my time with OAR so much, because it really then, you know, gives life to this strategy of advertising, marketing, like telling people proactively that there's something they could be doing, catching them in the car with a radio ad or, kind of internet-based advertising in other ways. And that's just not something we do in traditional healthcare. Like, we're here for you. You can be our patient, but you got to kind of come on in and tell us what's going on, and then we'll consider a treatment plan. Whereas with a kind of direct-to-consumer model like OAR, you're really kind of just able to get out ahead of it in a way that probably hasn't happened for people in a confidential, private way for this kind of stigmatized, often shameful condition that people are just hesitant or unable to ever talk to a doctor about.
What we've found is that there are large groups of people who may or may not use the word alcoholic to describe themselves, who may or may not have the goal of abstinence relative to moderation, who may or may not ever feel comfortable going to a doctor's office or a medical center or a clinic and having a face-to-face discussion with someone in their community. And our feeling is all of those people still deserve help and treatment, and telemedicine is a great tool to make that available to them.
Yeah, telemedicine definitely help, and especially can help people who live in a very remote area can still have access to really good care, right? I think that changed a lot of things.
Totally. I sometimes think of one member who told me that she lived in a very rural community and knew personally each of the physicians and the one pharmacist that were within driving distance, and really didn't want to talk about her alcohol use with any of them. And so something like OAR was a really great solution for her.
Right. That's the privacy piece you talk about, which is important, because I can imagine there's a lot of stigma, a lot of shame around it. And sounds like OAR Health specifically target alcohol abuse and alcohol use disorders.
Yeah, that's right. We've started with a focus just on alcohol. There are similar companies addressing, for example, opioid use disorder like Bicycle Health and Ophelia that have similar models. And who knows, we may partner or ourselves address other issues of addiction. But we think there's still a lot of good to be done in alcohol. 30 million people meeting the diagnostic criteria, less than 10% getting treatment. That's a lot of people to help and a lot of business opportunity.
Definitely. When you talk about the numbers, right, the numbers is really shocking how many people are suffering and how many actually are seeking help. But I'm wondering, you mentioned, yes, it's like advertising, marketing, but there's also psychological readiness, this motivation things. Like at least in our psychology world, we see that a lot. And this, even psychologists talk about 5-stage of change model, right? I think that's applying to this addiction world a lot. Yep. So how do you manage that? Because people can hear, okay, there's a resource available, but their motivation level may not be there to say, I'm going to contact even this easy access Aura Health, right? So I think you're still going to run into this motivation problem.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's something we've thought a lot about, readiness for change and how we build relationships with those who are in an earlier stage, maybe just the contemplation stage. And so have tried to build out resources and the ability to subscribe to our newsletter, for example, which has content related to alcohol and health, meeting one's drinking goals with or without the help of medication. And so, encourage anyone who's maybe in the earlier stages of thinking about sobriety, sober curious, just drinking less, how much should I be drinking, to check out some of those resources to stay in touch with people like us, whether they ever become a patient of one of our clinicians or a customer of Aura Health's is secondary. We would invite anyone who's rethinking their relationship with alcohol to check out our resources and to think about what's the right level of alcohol consumption for them, their health, their family, their goals. How do you handle that in your office, Josh, when someone's not quite ready to start treatment?
Yeah, clearly the more motivated, ready to change, experienced, knowledgeable person, patient, the better. That probably does predict a more likelihood of success for that treatment episode in any kind of behavior change. And certainly treating someone's alcohol with naltrexone, which is our basic, prospect. That said, we're trying to get everyone the same basic info. And then if you can spend time with someone, of course, you can work on that level of motivation. And hopefully, through the usual approaches that we know as motivational interviewing, that's kind of the doctor office version. Get them better educated and a little more motivated each time you talk about it for, a change attempt. That said, I strongly believe in kind of putting stuff in the water. Like, let's just give everybody, at least basic access to the thing that works. It's not going to stick among the least motivated, but they're going to maybe have realized earlier on than they would have that there is an option, that there is an avenue for, in this case, like pretty simple medical treatment. Like, you have a medical condition, I have a pharmaceutical, pill for you, I'm a doctor, meet me in a month to see how it went. Like, we can really normalize it and make it like we treat a lot of other problems in primary care, behavioral health or medical. And even a under or lower motivation person, that might be new enough to them that it's surprising in a good way. And then that in itself can, like, up the motivation level. So regardless of someone's motivation level, they still need, kind of the right messaging and to kind of the reassurance to know that there's an option there. And then I think you're right, though, that people are going to come at it at different times of their own experience and process. And part of what we're doing is just trying to get the motivation up while we're administering the treatment for the first time.
Right. Here are some good things about empowering the potential patients and the stigmatizing the the shame, the issue. And also it sounds like there's a sense of community around, like they, if they are in the newsletter or they keep on getting the message, if it's warm message, makes them feel like, oh, I'm understood, I'm not alone, right? I know that's the community sense is important in alcohol treatment. And traditionally there's AA meetings, there's like, you know, those kind of like one-on-one supervisions, those kind of things. So I'm wondering for your platform, for your model, is there anything similar to AA group or like how to deliver that through telemedicine?
Yeah, we do maintain a private, confidential online community for our members. Some, it's optional. You know, some folks who come to us do so because they want to make a fairly independent effort at this. They want the help from the medication, plus their own plan, plus perhaps support that they're able to rally in their families and communities. And they don't want someone looking over their shoulder every day or every week. And we want to help those people. But there's also a segment of members that have opted in to this community, whether it's just to connect with other people on this same medication that they're on, which can be hard to find in the world at large, or the more traditional benefits of community, having people who've gone before you share tips, tricks, strategies, having folks who can provide support and, in the difficult moments and encouragement and celebration as you hit milestones. So we are seeing that that community piece is quite important to some folks. And in order to kind of build on what's developed organically among those members, as meaningful as that is, we've actually just partnered with Smart Recovery, which is a mutual peer support organization, but one that is secular and evidence-based in its approach, to sponsor a Smart Recovery meeting that's geared towards OR members and others who are pursuing medication-assisted recovery, as Smart calls it, because we're learning that at least for some folks, that combination of medication plus community is the right one. I would never say that there's some secret set of treatment ingredients that is the perfect fit for everybody. It really does vary individual to individual, but we really do believe that everyone kind of has the right to assemble that toolkit that works for them. And we're seeing for some of our members, it's medication plus AA. For others, it's medication plus the organic OR community. And now for some, it's medication plus Smart Recovery.
Okay. Great. That I like that approach that is very individualized, but link all the resources together to make them available and or at least make people aware. So if I understand correctly, what you are doing is mainly you provide medical treatment, but you do link other resources or include some kind of support, no matter it's behavioral health or AA meeting, community support, peer support, all the other things is in the picture. But what you guys mainly do is medication management part. Is that right?
That's exactly right. Kind of when we, you know, started this company, we felt like we had to start somewhere. We hope we're part of this broader project of broadening the menu of treatment and support options that are available to people, but obviously not possible to do all of those things all at once. And so we have chosen to focus on what felt both to Josh and me as one of the most undersupplied options on the menu, which is that access to safe, effective, FDA-approved medication.
Right. So can, like, I'm curious for this medication treatment, what is the recovery rate and relapse rate and how effective medication treatment is for alcohol disorders?
Mm-hmm. I could take that. It's not a silver bullet. It's not a magic cure. It's not going to work in everyone. On average, though, it does perform better than placebo or usual treatment that is kind of like counseling only without medication in the largest clinical trials. In our own kind of data, a normal experience would be it helped me, and I've been on it kind of like 6 to 12 months. And it helped me not necessarily become completely abstinent from alcohol, back to like what your goals were when you started the process, but it helped me gain control and reduce my alcohol use overall. So it can also depend on what outcomes you're talking about. A classic outcome in Alcohol Anonymous is like never drink again and go to tons of meetings. So we're not talking about that necessarily. We're more talking about like improved function and staying in touch with the treatment provider, whether that's me in my doctor's office or through the OAR kind of membership. We recommend people be on the medication for a year or longer. It's not necessarily for the rest of your life. Like say if you have diabetes, you might be looking at being on a medication forever. This is probably not that. And most people don't want to use it forever and ever, particularly if they have a lot of success with it and feel like they have gotten control over their drinking or they're not drinking anymore. There's often a time, a year out or longer, when they're ready to use it less, not daily, still have it around, or not use it at all. So it is a little trial and error, and it is customizable in terms of how long you want to take it and for what purposes. But I would say, back to your original question, you know, can I quit drinking this year? I'm a heavy drinker. I've had some attempts to quit. They've never worked. I have other negative consequences from alcohol. I have like a moderate alcohol use disorder. I'm just going to stop spontaneously on my own. That would be the lowest probability of success. I'm going to consider going to AA and might talk to a health professional sometime in the 12 months. That's probably a little better option of success. But then if you can say, I'm definitely going to start this medication, I think then you're talking about like 2, 3, 4, 5 people out of 10, not everybody, but like a really solid chunk of this group is going to start to show, you know, positive effects and get and have a lot less drinking over time. So the medication is probably about the most effective first line thing you can do if you had to choose between just kind of pushing 12-step, starting some counseling. All of that is good and can work and can be done together. But if you had to just pick one thing to do and you're, you know, setting the odds on this in Vegas, using the medication daily is probably the most successful strategy.
So sounds like it's not a magical cure. People cannot just rely on that and say, I'm just going to do this. It's easy. Just take an appeal. I don't know anything else. But it's a place to that people can consider to get started with.
Yeah, totally. In epidemiology and pharma, we talk about number needed to treat. This is getting very med school on you. But the number needed to treat for alcohol and oral naltrexone is around kind of like 5 to 8, meaning I have to prescribe it to 5 people to get one person to have a really solid positive outcome, which often to a layperson doesn't sound very good. Like, why didn't all 5 of them have a great outcome? But that compares like quite well to everything else we do in medicine. SSRIs, say Prozac for depression, most first-line hypertension drugs for newly diagnosed hypertension, medications like metformin to control your blood sugar when you're diagnosed with diabetes. People have trouble taking medication every day. They have trouble just staying with it, following up, getting it refilled every month on time. So all those you can also kind of take in consideration. We try and smooth that out with OAR and make it as easy as possible to have a pill that you can take every day with as few barriers as possible. That is, you know, we're in the realm of like other things we do constantly in medicine because they're effective and they're really kind of the pillars of like primary care for a lot of common conditions. You can put naltrexone for alcohol in that same bin.
Yeah, you covered the barrier because I was about to ask what are some barriers. I'm thinking about financial burden for some people, right? And of course, telemedicine help with the access a lot, with the distance, things like that already, and the privacy you talk about. So how do you handle those kind of other barriers, no matter it's financial or something else?
Yeah, so we've thought about kind of there being 3 most common barriers to folks getting access to this frontline medication. The first is awareness. Most people have never heard of naltrexone. So if your listeners are hearing this term for the first time, they shouldn't feel alone. That's the more common experience. And that's a big part of what we do at OAR, just raising awareness of this option, whether folks end up getting the medication through us or a healthcare provider in their community. We think both of those are fantastic options. The second barrier that we hear very commonly is that not every healthcare professional is comfortable and confident prescribing naltrexone or other medications for alcohol use disorder, or more broadly, treating addiction in their practice. And so that's something we go at very directly at OAR, in that we have a panel of clinicians who are interested in treating alcohol use disorder, who've been trained on the recommended approach, who've learned about naltrexone and how they can use their prescription pad to get people started. And then the last barrier that we hear commonly from our members is that in some traditional treatment settings, you know, there is still an aversion to the use of prescription medication. You still hear saying sometimes like, don't replace one drug with another, which we don't think is a particularly relevant criticism of a medication like naltrexone that is not subject to abuse, that does not have potential for addiction, but it's still something that people hear. And so that's where both the upfront education and then the community, seeing people who are engaged in this same change project and making progress, can help to knock down that remaining stigma. I think all three of these trends, awareness, healthcare professional readiness, and stigma, we're making progress on them. We just want to go a lot faster in making that progress than we have over the last 10, 20, or 30 years.
Right.
And then to speak to kind of your point about affordability, one of the good attributes of naltrexone, and this is of course not true of all medications, is that it is generic and therefore relatively affordable. So we don't see affordability as the foremost barrier for this particular medication. You know, in particular, if you contrast the cost of starting out on this medication with, for example, specialty inpatient treatment.
Great to know. Yeah.
The generic status of naltrexone is kind of a blessing and a curse. The blessing part is that it's cheap. The curse is that there's no pharma company out there with the economic incentive to make it a household name like Prozac or Viagra.
Yeah. So need a lot of education to help people understand, right? Okay. And do you guys collaborate with insurance? Like, can people use insurance, health insurance, to seek help from your team?
At OAR Health, no. At this point, we are not set up to accept insurance. And so we're not always the lowest cost option. And so for some members, it will make more sense for them to connect with a healthcare professional in their community, like Josh, if you live in New York, and who accepts insurance, and then to use their pharmacy benefit, commercial Medicare, Medicaid at the pharmacy counter. That can be a lower cost option than OAR Health in some situations. What we find is that there are folks who need the convenience and the privacy and are willing to pay out of pocket at what we hope are affordable rates.
Right. I see. That's very important and helpful information for, I think, no matter the whoever are listening, if they are thinking about seek help, right? And it depends on their personal needs. Or if sometimes we have healthcare providers listen to this show and they will have an idea when to refer and at least prepare the potential patients to know the pros and cons, and then they can go ahead, seek out help or talk to your team more. Yeah.
Yeah, it's a great point for healthcare professionals in the audience. The NIAAA, National Institute on Alcohol Abuse and Alcoholism, just last year published a new core resource on treating alcohol problems that is a great starting point and highlights what we've been talking about relative to the under-prescription of naltrexone and other medications. So we definitely recommend that to the healthcare professionals in the audience.
Right. Great. This is very helpful. And if our listeners want to find more information about what we talk about our health, where can they find you and find the information?
So it all starts at orhealth.com, O-A-R health.com. A lot of resources to help understand alcohol misuse, alcohol use disorder, treatment options, including medication-assisted treatment, some of the details of naltrexone, how it works, side effects, who it's appropriate for, who it's not. And then if based on all that, it seems like it might be a good fit, the right tool at the right time, orhealth.com, oarhealth.com is the place to get started with a consultation with a doctor or nurse practitioner or other clinician who can evaluate whether medication-assisted treatment might be right for any individual.
Great. Thanks for the information. And sounds like they can subscribe to your email newsletter if they want. They're not ready, fully ready yet, or just want to get connected with the community.
Exactly. A lot of options.
Right. Great. So at the end of the show, any last wisdom you want to share with all the listeners?
There's really good treatment out there, and it's easier to get it than you think, and it's worth a shot for a lot of stuff, but in particular for alcohol, and that includes naltrexone. Thank you.
I think I'm going to echo Josh. Recovery from alcohol use disorder and other substance use disorders is possible. I'm one example of that. There are millions of others. Treatment options exist. It pays to do a little bit of research to understand what some of those options are. They may be more numerous and varied than what you've previously thought. It pays to trust your instinct on which options might be the right fit for you. And then lastly, it's never too early or too late to get started on a change project. You don't have to wait to hit rock bottom to start changing your relationship with a substance. But on the other side of that coin, no matter how dark and difficult things may feel, movement in the right direction is always possible.
Yeah, thank you very much. It's important to remember, never give up hope and seek out help and seek out resources out there. Yeah. Thank you, Jonathan and Dr. Lee, for your share. And hopefully this is very helpful to many of the listeners and for people who are thinking about getting treatment or who are looking for resources.
Thank you for having us.
Thanks for having me.
So what do you think about today's conversation? And what's your opinion about treatment for alcohol use disorder? Leave me a message. Let me know. So the video version of this conversation will be available online on our YouTube channel at Deep Into Sleep Podcast. If you know someone struggles with insomnia, please check out my insomnia treatment course CBTI online at manbodygarden.com/insomnia. Thank you for your interest in sleep science and wish you a good night of sleep. Thank you very much for listening and watching. I'm Dr. Yi Shan. See you next time. Bye.
Sleep is an individual thing. We all sleep differently, and there is so much we can do to improve sleep quality. Keep hope and carry on. This podcast is for general informational purpose only and does not include the practice of medicine or other health professional services. Usage of the information we share is at the listener's own risk, and our content does not intend to be a substitute for any medical and professional services, diagnoses, and treatment. Please seek professional health services as needed.